morning, everyone. Welcome to our House Committee on Transportation Policy, Wednesday, March 22nd, 2017, on this fine spring day. I think we can actually say that. Good morning, Vice Chair. We have an agenda. We are going out of order most of the morning, just so you know, so try and keep up. We are going to start by opening a work session on House Bill 2482A, and I will let Mr. Walker enlighten us for a moment, and then Representative Bence, if you'd like to come up. And
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, House Bill 2482A permits certain filling stations, service stations, garages, or other dispensaries of Class 1 flammable liquids to allow self-dispensing 24 hours per day in counties with a certified population of less than 40,000 residents. There's a no fiscal impact has been issued and a minimal revenue impact. There is an A4 amendment in front of you that requires a dispensary of retail fuel, which includes retail space providing goods and services other than goods and services for maintaining, repairing, or cleaning a motor vehicle, to provide an employee, owner, or operator to dispense Class 1 flammable liquids between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. if the retail portion of the business is open.
And you all may recall that this bill was voted out of committee. We have brought it back for further work with the great good graces of Representative Bence and Representative Witt. And I'll let Representative Bence explain what the amendment actually does and move forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As for the record, Cliff Bence, State Representative District 60. You should have before you a map of Oregon. Looks like this. This amendment applies only to the three counties on the coast. The bill, as originally crafted, did not apply to those three counties. This amendment addresses a situation that exists on the counties now, in those three counties now, where you would drive up at 6 at night, see people in the convenience store, but nobody would help you if you wanted to have your gasoline pumped for you. This bill basically says that if you drive up at 6 at night, between 6 at night and 6 in the morning, and there's someone there, they have to serve you. And that's what this amendment does. And the concept was simple enough. It was to make sure that perhaps jobs that otherwise might be lost along the coast won't be. That's the concept.
Thank you, Representative.
I think it's a good addition, and I fully support it.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for Representative Bence? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to state on the record that I very much appreciate Representative Bence's fine work on this amendment, and he is a gentleman always and a great statesman, and just enjoy working with him very much.
Thank you, Representative Witt. I neglected to open a work session. Did I open a work session?
You did.
Did I open a work session? Okay, good. All right, thank you. Make sure we're doing everything by the book on this one and get it out in good order. I will turn to Vice Chair Vile now.
Chair McKellen, I move to adopt the -A4 amendment dated 3/16/17 to House Bill 2482.
Vice Chair Vile moves to adopt the -4 amendment dated 3/16/17. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Chair McEwen, I move House Bill 2482A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Vile moves House Bill 2482A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Clerk, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Barreto.
Aye.
Representative Evans.
Yes.
Representative McLean.
Aye.
Representative Noble.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative
Bio.
Aye.
Chair McEwen.
Aye. The motion passes. Representative Bence, would you like to carry this bill one more time?
Happily, Madam Chair, and thank you so much for rehearing the bill, and thank Representative Witt for his only modestly overstated remarks.
Thank you, sir. And we will close our work session on House Bill 2482A. And I believe that we have Representative Marsh is not in the room. Is that correct? So we will open a work session on House Bill 2745. Mr. Walker?
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, 2745 was in front of you on March 1st and tonight or today. And this, if you remember, allows intergovernmental entities with consent of local jurisdictions to levy property taxes for transit services that are tailored to the needs of individual communities. There is a revenue light which has been issued by LRO for the purposes of moving this to revenue, and they will do further analysis then. There is no fiscal impact. You have a dash one amendment in front of you, which limits the applicability to non-rail transportation facilities and states the estimated amount of the ad valorem taxes to be stated in per thousand of assessed value. Specifies that if the territory of an intergovernmental entity is divided into zones, the board shall declare the ad valorem property tax for each zone.
Yes. And I will turn to Vice Chair Meek.
Chair McEwen, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated 2/28/17.
Vice Chair Meek moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated 2/28/17. Is there any discussion? Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to briefly say that I commend the folks for trying to be innovative at the local level. I know that sometimes the obvious answer may be just to form something whole and new. But in this particular case, existing governments working together to find ways to make it happen, I think, is smart governance. So I'm excited about this bill.
Thank you for that acknowledgement, Representative Evans. Any further discussion? Is there any objection? If not, the amendments are adopted. Vice Chair Meek.
Chair McEwen, I move House Bill 2745 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Vice Chair Meek moves House Bill 2745 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Clerk, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Evans.
Aye.
Representative McClain.
Aye.
Representative Noble.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Barreto.
Aye.
Vice Chair Meek.
Aye.
Vice Chair Vile.
Aye.
Chair McEwen.
Aye. The motion passes. I'm going to make an assumption that Representative Huffman would like to carry this if there is no objection from the committee.
Going to revenue, so we won't need a carry.
Oh, thank you. We'll let him figure that out later. Thank you, Mr. Walker. And I'm going to close our work session on 2745. We're on a roll, so let's keep going and open a work session on House Bill 2910. Mr. Walker.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, House Bill 2910 is a bill that requires snowmobiles and certain all-terrain vehicles to cross highway at intersections or 100 feet from intersection, allows the road authority to authorize incidental use of the highway right-of-way by all-terrain vehicles, including paved portion, shoulder, inside bank, or slope, and median of a divided highway that the road authority has designated as an all-terrain access route. There is a no revenue statement has been issued and a minimal fiscal impact statement has been issued. You have a dash two amendment in front of you, and I will let Representative Barreto explain the dash two amendment. If that's
thank you, sir. Representative Barreto.
Yeah, thank you. Chair McHugh and Vice Chair Vile, Vice Chair Meek, and committee. Greg Barreto, State Rep, House District 58.
This bill was developed by a work group that was instituted in 2015 by Senate Bill 192. I didn't know about that work group when I had a call from a constituent a couple of years ago and said, hey, we can't even drive our snowmobile across the state highway up at Tollgate without breaking the law. Can we do something about that? And so we started to introduce this, and then Senator Farioli told me that they already had this work group set up. They had the same issue down there. And so working with him to develop this bill that would allow, primarily allow ATVs to be used on state highways in very limited portions. And so working with ODOT, we came up with this bill. And so it allows ATVs to operate on state highways. There's a work group that was put together to advise this. It was the work group was ATV users, dealers, staff from ODOT, and other community off-road users. And the work group was to provide recommendations, submit a report to the interim committee. The purpose and scope of the report the work group developed was to provide a set of specific recommendations allowing limited, underscore limited, operations of ATVs on Oregon state highways to provide associated background and the process for information. And so the Dash 2 amendment basically says that you can cross a highway, state highway, at an intersection or at least 100 feet away from that intersection, but not within that boundary. Also directs Oregon Transportation Commission to designate ATV access routes throughout the state. It sets up an advisory committee. It's an all-volunteer ATV access routes advisory committee that specifies actually, on that committee are two ATV users, city or county rep, law enforcement member of the public, and then they are to accept and evaluate proposals for these ATV access routes. They are to consult with local and county commissioners, sheriff, and local road authorities, local land management agencies, and city reps if they're in a city, then to conduct a public meeting to inform the public, and then to consider the need for ATV connections in those areas, minimize impacts to adjacent landowners and the road conditions, local communities, desire for connectivity, promote tourism, consistency, and safety. Also on this committee are Parks Department and ODOT, and they are non-voting members. And the idea is to designate these ATV access routes throughout the state that are acceptable to the local communities. Now, I would also say the difference between the bill Senator Farioli put in over on the Senate side and this one, and I don't know what he's changed as far as amendments on his, but he had it designated for counties under 20,000 people. And so that wiped out a lot of Oregon. And I said, I can't go with that. I mean, every county has these little rural areas where they use ATVs. And so over in my area, I mean, just going from La Grande up to Wallowa, you have Imbler, Enterprise, Wallowa, Lostien, Joseph, over where I am in Union, Cove. And most of these towns have a gas station. People, they're small towns. When you go through on a state highway, it's 25 miles an hour. These state highways go right through the middle of town. And people already use these. I mean, they already illegally use these highways just to go down and fill up their ATV or whatever. So for these small rural communities where you don't have a lot of traffic, you don't have a lot of travel, it really does make sense. And especially as we see the ATV market almost exponentially growing, these things will be used. So I would be glad to take any questions. We did work with ODOT, with Amy Joyce a lot, drafting this up. And so if you have any questions, I would either take them or refer to her.
Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. I have a couple questions. The first one is I'm not familiar with the current laws on ATVs that are off-road, but do you have to wear a helmet or any protective equipment these days?
Yeah, thank you for that question, Chair McEwen, Representative Evans. In order to operate on a state highway, you have to, first of all, have a driver's license or a permit. You have to have a helmet. You have to have insurance on the vehicle also. What am I missing here? Oh, and seat belts. And so if it's a side-by-side ATV that comes with original equipment of seat belts, you have to use your seat belt too.
So you would have to wear your helmet across the road?
That's correct.
Okay. And the second question, if I could
follow up,
is do you foresee this opening the door to more illegal use of the roads? Maybe I was going to go across the intersection, there's no one around, so I'm just going to keep going.
Well, they have to stay under 65 miles an hour now. I think whenever you make a law, it gets stretched. I mean, I'm just being honest. You know, you raise the speed limit over in Eastern Oregon to 65, and people go 75. You know, here it's 65, or here it's 70, they go 80. Here it's 65, they go 75. People always push that. You know, and so can I say no? This won't expand that. I see it as allowing something that is more or less convenient, I think, to the rural areas. And the other thing that I don't think I mentioned was that it has to work within the cities and the counties. I mean, this state highway committee, local communities already have the opportunity to do this on their side roads, on their city roads, on gravel county roads, things like that. And what this does is allows basically very small portions of state highways to be part of that access route.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Any other questions for Representative? All right, thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Vice Chair Vile.
Chair McEwen, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated 3-14-17 to House Bill 2910.
Vice Chair Vile moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated 3-14-17. Is there any further discussion? If not, the amendments are adopted.
Chair McEwen, I move House Bill 2910 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Vile moves House Bill 2910 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, Clerk, will you call the roll?
Representative McLean.
Aye.
Representative Noble.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Barreto.
Aye.
Representative Evans.
Yes.
Vice Chair Meek.
Aye.
Vice Chair Vile.
Aye.
Chair McEwen.
Aye. The motion passes. Representative Barreto to carry.
I would love to carry it. Thank you.
Thank you. And we will close our work session on 2910. And we have two of our colleagues joining us today. Thank you very much. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2922. Thank you. Thank you for joining us this morning. Welcome to our committee. Mr. Walker?
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, House Bill 2922 increases the surcharge collected for the issuance of Crater Lake National Park registration plates from $10 to $15.
Please.
For the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, Medford. Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Vile, Vice Chair Meek. Crater Lake plates, what you have in front of you, House Bill 2922 is an increase of the plate surcharge. And we're not doing this just because we want to, it's because there is a purpose, and I will tell you what that is. Crater Lake plates have been issued since the 100th anniversary of the Crater Lake National Park in 2002. Over 250,000 sets of plates have been sold since that time to create an endowment for the Oregon Community Foundation that supports education research at the park. They continue to sell over 1,200 sets of plates per month. Currently, it's the least expensive custom plate and offered at a one-time surcharge. The additional cost of these custom plates and administration charge is $4.18 from ODOT, from the DMV, and subject to increased costs over time. The legislature sets the selling price of the plates. Increasing the one-time surcharge from $20 to $30 per set offers, and that's front and back, so it's $5 each plate, offers Oregonians an inexpensive way to supporting a program and projects at Crater Lake National Park and have the plates that show off Oregon's natural icon in their plates. Most importantly, the additional funds added to the endowment will help support proposed Crater Lake Rim Village Information and Education Center. We currently have a Rim Village, and the federal government has just completed a very large task of redoing the lodge, but this will also work into the Rim Village and also the Education Center that needs to be revamped. The federal government will come in with about $8 million, and this will raise about our end of the $8 million. So it's kind of a match in a way. But operating costs for the science, the education center, and the Rim Village is about $50,000 to $100,000 per year. So this is why we're here in front of this committee asking that we increase that price by $5 per plate.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Marsh, welcome.
Thank you, Chair McEwen, members of the committee. Thank you so much for having me. I'm pleased to be here to speak in support of House Bill 2922. Crater Lake, of course, is one of our iconic attractions, our only national park in the state of Oregon. And certainly it's an attraction not only for those of us who live here in the state, but for visitors from across the nation and even across the globe. Last year, in 2016, the park had a record-setting year for attendance. Ever since a bigger attendance at just over 700,000, which eclipsed records dating back to 1904. So people are coming to visit Crater Lake, and they're taking a little part of that home in their hearts. In thinking about this morning, I wondered how just the regular person sees Crater Lake. So I went online and I looked at consumer reviews of Crater Lake. You will not be surprised to hear that it gets 5-star rankings as visitors talk about its stunning beauty. There is always, of course, some cranky person in the crowd, and there was in this case, who said that it contained an incredibly large and creepy lake and gave Crater Lake 1 star. But what we know really is that we all love Crater Lake. I think it's important as you look at this to note that access to our wild places is important, but how we talk about them and how we learn and how we educate is actually key to protecting those places as well. And the development of the education center is a step toward really explaining the natural beauty of Crater Lake, the history of it, the role that it's played in our native culture, and a huge contribution, I think, to the visitor experience at Crater Lake. So I support this bill. I think it's a good way to raise some funds to really further develop the park and make that visitor experience even more extraordinary for the nearly million people who will be visiting in the next few years. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Do we have questions for our colleagues? Yes, Representative McLean.
Do you guys know if you are the number one selling specialty plate?
I don't know that.
Ms. Joyce may be able to answer that question. I'm not sure. Yeah. She'll be up in a minute.
Okay.
We have to be in the running, though.
Yeah, I think
the one thing about Crater Lake, it was Mount Mazama, and it was over 10,000 feet. Now, the rim itself today is 7,000 feet, mm-hmm. and you go down probably another 1,000 feet, and then the lake is 2,000 feet. So imagine how much real estate blew off that thing when it mm-hmm. went.
Yeah.
So it's quite an extraordinary geological feature.
Other questions?
Yes, Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Escoval, one of my travel vans has the Crater Lake plates on it, and I drive to Idaho, Washington, and California advertising this beautiful attraction. Do I get credit for that?
No, actually, we'll just keep that in Southern Oregon, sir.
But
thank you.
Very good work. I'm supportive of this.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Joyce? Is there anyone else that would like to speak to this bill? Ms. Joyce is the only one that I have listed. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair McEwen and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. To answer your question, Representative McLean, this plate is by far the best-selling specialty plate. I think, as Representative Esquivel indicated, over 1,000 a month for comparison. Salmon, which we're all familiar with as well, sells maybe 125 a month, that sort of thing. Just here available to answer any questions. The sponsors did a nice job summarizing what will happen. This plate sells very well. A small increase to the surcharge. It's a one-time surcharge that's paid. And what DMV transfers, ODOT transfers funds to the organization is the surcharge less a small administrative fee. And over time, those fees just go up. The cost for producing the plate over and above what the tree plate costs and the administrative handling things. We can't use highway fund dollars to do those things, so it has to come out of the surcharge, and that's gone up a little bit over time since 2002 when this plate was first issued, and the surcharge amount hasn't gone up since then. We'll need to make some minor computer changes, forms changes, that sort of thing. So there will be a relatively small cost, as license plates go, to implement this bill, but that also can come out of the surcharge over time. So that's my testimony.
Ms. Joyce, we have seven new members on our committee who were not here in the last session when we revamped how the state of Oregon and ODOT manages vanity plates. And I would like to just get on the record very clearly that this bill does not change the work that was done in 2015 to codify for ODOT how license plates that are vanity plates or specialty plates are acquired. Could you just give us a little brief update for our seven new members about what we used to do and what we're doing now and why this does not impact that?
Sure, Chair McEwen. So in the past, new specialty plates were always a creature of statute. If you wanted a new specialty plate, you introduced a bill, created those plates, and over time, those are things like Crater Lake, Salmon, Cultural Trust, Pacific Wonderland, Wine Country. And then last session in 2015, there was a bill that created two new specialty plates, but then really kind of shut down that process and moved the creation of new specialty plates to an administrative process at the DMV involving things like pre-sales to ensure that there was enough interest in a proposed plate, and then mandatory minimum sales per year going forward, which doesn't exist for the plates that were created by statute. So it really shifted this process out of the legislative body and more to an administrative function. But Crater Lake, this and this bill doesn't change that at all. Just it's a very small change to slightly increase the fee.
Thank you for the clarification. Yes,
Representative McLean.
Certainly.
Well, first of all, I had a specialty plate that I did with Representative Kinnamer in 2015, and it did pass. And it's actually sitting there because I got caught between the old and the new system and also came in with the Trailblazers. And so their plate, they had a little bit more money than I did as far as getting it off the ground. And so we still have a plate out there, if anybody wants to help me, that has been agreed to, which is on treating breast cancer, and it also needs about $110,000 to get it off the ground. So I've been working hard with cancer associations, but most of theirs deals with actually research versus treatment. And mine was on testing, early testing, to try to make sure that we got folks in to find out about their condition. And this was for folks that really needed the help. So I just wanted to say there is one plate out there, and it is passed, and we just need to get a little bit of money to get it off the ground.
Thank you, Representative McLean, for drawing attention to that very worthy cause. And I appreciate the work that you did with us in the last session to get what was becoming a runaway program under control and handled through ODOT in a very specific way. And I just wanted to make sure people understand this doesn't change that. We're not opening the door to another 10 plate bills a year that we all have to deal with. We're still under a system that is well-regulated. And I think very reasonable. So thank you, Ms. Joyce.
Thank you.
Chairman.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Amy, as long as we're doing a tell-all on license plates here, I've always wondered who actually makes the plates that we sell here in Oregon.
Chair McEwen and Representative Wilson, that is an Oregon company, and they're up in Portland, and they've been the company that's been the vendor of plates in Oregon for many, many decades. It's a common myth that license plates are always made by inmates. That's not the case in Oregon. It's an Oregon company, and I've been up to visit it. There's a guy with a big press stamping numbers into plates. It's fascinating. There's also a part of their company is in Canada, and a lot of the plates that have the sheeting rather than stamped are made there, but it is Oregon-based.
Great. Thank you. It is fascinating, and part of the reason that we wanted to work on kind of changing the process was, if I remember correctly, Ms. Joyce, we ended up we had storage problems. We had plates all over the place that were left unsold, and it was creating storage problems for ODOT. It was very confusing. This is, I think, a much more streamlined, thoughtful process. So, any other questions? All right. We have three people that would like to... Oh, this is the next... I'm sorry. Next one. We're going to close the public hearing on 2922, and we will open a public hearing... let's see. I want to make sure. Do we have, Mr. Walker, we had talked about doing these at 9:15 when Representative.
Okay, I can email him.
Are we flexible?
I don't know. I can find out, or we could just go with the application. Is that a this round?
So we don't know if he's able to come a little bit early. Okay. We have a little scheduling issue with one of our colleagues. So I think what I will do, we have three people here to testify on 2749. Miss, your good representative is not scheduled to be here until 9:15. So I think what I would like to do is bring up Mr. Malik and do our informational meeting on highway cost allocation study, and then do everything that involves the two bills around the Port of Hood River and the bridge when Representative Huffman is able to be here. So, Mr. Malik, welcome to our committee today. We have seven new members, and we're delighted to have you today to talk to us today about the cost allocation study, the highway cost allocation study. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me this morning. The record, my name is Mazen Malik. I'm with the Legislative Revenue Office. And it's good to see all the familiar faces and the new faces here. Good to be with the committee. What we bring to you today is the highway cost allocation study. And after the highway cost allocation study, we also have another study called the flat fee study. And the highway cost allocation study is a study that is mandated in a way in the Constitution of the State of Oregon. And it primarily tries to find out and make sure that the proportionality of payment of taxes between the heavy vehicles and the light vehicles that are proportional and fair relative to the amount that they exact on the transportation system. And for that endeavor, we actually, the statutes, as the state economist or the DAS, Office of Economic Analysis, to oversee the study. And he does by putting together a study review team, and that study review team kind of hires a consultant, and the consultant goes and does all that work for all that data. It actually gets very, very involved. We look at every segment of the highway, every VMT, how they do it, where they go, what's the split between the lanes, which project takes the different allocation, and so on. And basically, we will bring now to the table coming Mr. Mark McMillan, who's the state economist, and he'll bring with him a couple of your SRT that you probably could get introduced to. And now these people have been working in the transportation and in the cost allocation process for a long time. So with your permission, Madam Chair.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Chair McEwen, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark McMullen, Oregon State Economist, and as Mazin mentioned, I am here to take care of the constitutional requirement to report the results of the 2017 Highway Cost Allocation Study. For all the new members, our consultant is going to give you details about the language in the Constitution and the techniques that we use to go ahead and try to solve this issue. But at a very high level, what we're really doing here is just try to see if the taxes paid by light vehicles in terms of predominantly fuel taxes and heavy vehicles, which is predominantly the weight mile tax, are fair and proportional with respect to the costs on the road, and or in particular expenditure, what mix of expenditures that the legislature has allocated. Now, the upshot right now is that things are pretty darn close to fair where we are right now. But unfortunately, this is always a moving target. For one, the mix of traffic changes over time, the amount of light vehicles versus heavy trucks on the road changes over time, and perhaps even more importantly for this session is the mix of highway spending changes. In particular, should the body come up with a new transportation package, that's going to change the mix of spending, and to the extent that we put more spending on the types of highway costs that are incurred by trucks in terms of pavement that trucks tear up faster or bridges that require fancier engineering for trucks, that can change the balance and require us to alter those fees to keep them fair. So my role is all about process as the chair of the study review team. This is a very technical study. There's all sorts of details that make a lot of difference in terms of dollars, pavement factors, and the technology of building culverts and the like, and things that our stakeholders don't have time for in their limited time with policymakers like yourself. Would rather have bigger fish to fry than to deal with some of these technical issues, even though there are real dollars attached. So what we do is we get a lot of stakeholders together to hash these out and come up with something that works for everyone. As you see here, the team, we have folks from the Department of Transportation. We have the bikes, the cars, the trucks, the counties, and the like, and we go through these technical details in a series of meetings every 2 years along with our consultant. We wouldn't be able to do the study without the work of Echo Northwest, who has done the study for several years now and has become very adept at the modeling. And we also get quite a bit of support from the ODOT staff and Amy Williams at DAS. So with that, I'm going to pass it over to a couple of our long-serving members of the study review team to talk a little bit about the process, and then we'll go ahead and have the consultant give you the details.
And, sir, if you don't mind, I believe Representative Evans has a question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Chair. I Willamette University, what stakeholder group is that?
Yes, Chair McEwen, Representative Evans. We've always had some academics on the study review team as well.
In the future, Western Oregon University might be on that list.
Absolutely, absolutely. Don Negri has, and he often comes up with us here. He's taken an interest for some time and is quite familiar with the details of the study and helps us quite a bit. And he's located right across the street, which is easy. But Western Oregon isn't that far either.
Best answer. Thank you.
We'd be happy to have all the help we can get.
Thank you, sir.
Madam
Welcome,
Chair,
Mr.
members of the committee, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. Oregon has been doing cost allocation studies since 1937, I believe. I haven't been involved since then. However, I did get involved in in the early 80s, and I've been doing every study since that time. And in 1999, the trucking industry actually submitted a ballot measure and that put cost allocation in the Constitution. It's the newest change to Article 9 of the Constitution, and it requires that there be a study done every 2 years and that to determine proportional responsibility between cars and trucks, and that study is reported to you during your long session, and that's exactly why we're here. So the trucking industry supports our method of cost responsibility. It's kind of an interesting process to go through a study. We would invite you all to participate if you would like. Most folks, after about 10 minutes of listening to all the economists argue, decide that they have better things to do. But for us coneheads, we enjoy doing it and have done it for a long time. This particular study was fairly routine. We didn't do a lot of extracurricular looks at things. We just did the study as required, and it came out really close to where it did 2 years ago.
Mr. Campbell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Craig Campbell on behalf of AAA. You'll notice that I'm not one of the listed members up there. At times I've been a member, and the person listed up there is our CEO, and when the CEO decides he wants to be the member, then by gosh, the CEO gets to be the member. It's always exciting to come up and do color commentary for an exciting two-year process where you have a bunch of economists and data geeks around transportation sitting around doing very detailed machinations around who's responsible for what. But one of the things that's kind of important to realize around what we call a cost allocation study, it's really an expenditure allocation study. We look at how are we spending our money on the highway system, and then based upon those expenditures, who's causing those expenditures to be made between cars and trucks. In most instances, it's shared in some way or another. So what you're going to get is a very detailed, very competently done study that says, okay, who should be paying what part of the tax obligation between cars and trucks. That's going to be important for you in a couple of ways this time. One, you're very fortunate in that the study you're getting this time around, to the extent that these are usually very exciting, this one's rather boring. And the reason that's important is, one, as you're looking at a transportation funding package, it's much easier to start at a baseline and then determine how the tax obligation needs to be distributed between us two. And when that's done, Mr. Malik has the unenviable position of having to take all the new numbers, run them through the model that has been developed to figure out how they need to apportion taxes between cars and trucks. The other thing that I think when I testified last week on the road user fee, it's this study that's critical to make sure that if the state of Oregon ever decides to go in that direction, this study will tell us for automobiles how much the per mile tax needs to be in order for every motorist to pay their fair share. And so it has that side tool. One other thing, and Mr. Russell alluded to this, is this time we didn't do a lot of extracurricular studies, but in the past we've done a number of what we refer to as white papers, where if we have questions about something that really needs to be delved into deeper, like how do you apportion costs that aren't usually associated with the road, like CO2 emissions or noise pollution or the impact of accidents on congestion, those sort of things. We've in the past done papers that delve into that to help us treat those issues when we're doing the study. And we've actually done side-by-side studies to when we get to the point where we can actually use more technology to look at a broader way of doing cost allocation. But at this point in time, you've got a pretty straightforward study. And with that, I think I'll stop talking.
Gentlemen, I would be curious, with the expertise and the longevity of your experience, was there a point in time in our recent history where there was a significant adjustment that needed to be made?
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. In 1999, actually, which was the first study that was done under the auspices of the Office of Economic Analysis. And we did have a package that year, but it failed. And there was another bill that said if the package failed, that rates would be adjusted in truck rates in this case. And there was a 17% reduction in the weight mile tax rates, which was significant.
But that's the last time there's been some sort of a major...
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, one other deal, and it didn't result in the legislature having to take action, but there was a period of time when we had a large amount of federal funds that came in for bridge construction, and we needed to figure out how to take what essentially was a wave. And the problem is if you increase taxes on cars and then you're dealing with the truck taxes, if you have something that goes like this and then down, that means the legislature has to come in, increase one and decrease the other, and then switch them later on. And through one of those white papers on how to study that, we were able to figure out a way to make sure that the cost allocation study spread those costs over the life of the bridge rather than when the money came in, and it prevented us from having to come back to the legislature for a shift that really would have been very difficult to handle.
Right. Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative McLean.
I just want to make a statement that I don't want you to undersell a product, even a study like this, because, I mean, you've spent a lot of your time and energy in it, and I think that the chair and I feel like the last 6 to 8, 9 months of our life has been important, too. And this is the essence of what we have to understand any financial package or any financial undertaking that the state might do. So thank you for doing this work. But don't undersell your commitment or the product.
Madam Chair, Representative McLean, I should point out that although it's easy for me to underestimate my value, the people who do this study really know their stuff and do a great job. So if I ever insinuated
Good
that
catch.
They were experts,
Good
they
catch.
Really know what they're doing.
And colleagues, this is the work that a lot of our constituents will never see, but it's incredibly important work. So thank you all for your time and your dedication. We appreciate you being here today. Yes, Representative Barreto.
Yeah, no, it's easy for me to understate his value also.
You haven't heard him speak French yet. Wait, the day is coming.
Yeah, so other states must do these studies also. And so do we compare with other states? And then I would imagine weather is a factor. But then also road materials. You know, I've noticed road materials have changed over the years. And so I would assume that this would also take into account the cost of different materials, how long they last under certain conditions.
That's right, Chairman McEwen, Representative Barreto. We do spend a lot of time obsessing over pavement factors, and we actually have another subcontractor who gets into this exactly. And what the ODOT has some terrific ways of going around and measuring the grooves and the ruts in the pavement and the amount of cars and truck traffic, and they try to do their best to allocate those fairly. Now, it's obviously nothing's a perfect science, but they certainly do spend a lot of time on that and the different the different costs of the pavement that's used. That is one of the primary differences between the cars and the trucks, insofar as while trucks are only a small 5% of the miles on the highway, they do about a third of the cost, and a lot of that is through the wear and tear on the pavement.
Can I have a follow-up?
That's fine. Yes, sir.
So then also over where we are, I think truck chains play a huge role on the longevity of the highways, along with studded tires. And so in these studies, do you also take those into account?
Yes, Representative Barreto, we do. In particular, we lean on a studded tire study that the ODOT has completed, so that
okay.
We have an idea of what that is, and to allocate that as well as the chains. And you're right, there is quite a bit of damage that's done there. And our consultant can tell you in more detail if need be. But yes, we do our best to account for that.
And gentlemen, I would be curious as to whether other states use this cost responsibility model, or is this unique?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Bob Russell. Cost allocation used to be a lot more popular than it is today. There are a few states that occasionally do cost allocation studies. Idaho and Nevada are two. But most states haven't done them for years. The federal government used to do one every 10 years. But the federal government hasn't done anything with federal tax rates since 1993. So they haven't been doing them either. Oregon really is leading the way. in this particular area, and we would expect that more states will pick it up as we go to alternative financing mechanisms, like the BMT, tolling, those kinds of things. Other states are going to want to have some more refined way to setting those rates than other than doing this.
Great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, in addition to that, Oregon is unique in two other respects. Oregon is the only state in the union that actually fully apportions truck tax costs onto trucks through the weight mile tax, and we're the only one that uses the weight mile tax as the primary method of doing so. So it's really critical that we have a study that makes sure that we're apportioning amongst truck weights, because that's the other thing that this study does, is it identifies not only the share between cars and trucks, but also amongst truck weights where that tax needs to be apportioned. And because of Oregon's unique position in having the weight mile tax, our constitutional requirement for distributing taxes between cars and trucks, that's prior. Now, we were on the cutting edge before that, at least before the constitutional provision, but certainly it's a critical element, which is why we do such a good job on this particular study.
Thank you. No further questions? Thank you, gentlemen. I believe up next we have Mr. Batten.
Yes, and I believe Dan Porter as well with ODOT to do the flat fee study.
Thank you. Welcome, gentlemen. We're happy to have you here this morning.
Thank you, Chair McEwen, members of the committee. My name is Carl Batten. I'm an economist with Echo Northwest, an economics consulting firm based in Portland, Oregon. As Mr. Russell mentioned, Oregon's been doing highway cost allocation since 1937. This is the 20th study. They've been every 2 years since 1999. And the very first study was conducted by Condi McCullough, the same guy who designed all of the beautiful bridges on the Oregon coast.
And, sir, I happen to have the iconic McCullough Bridge in my district, which opened in 1936. My mother was on a float and rode across it as they opened the bridge. Yes.
So, and also, as has been mentioned several times, Oregon's Constitution requires the study every 2 years and requires that user fees be adjusted if the study finds that they aren't equitable. The exact wording of the Constitution is here. What's important is the question that we have to answer in this study, which is, are the shares of revenues paid by light and heavy vehicles fair and proportionate to their shares of costs? And in order to answer that question, we calculate what we call equity ratios. An equity ratio is the share of revenue for a particular weight class divided by the share of costs attributable to that weight class. If its share of revenue and share of cost are equal, that ratio will be 1.0, and we call that equitable. If it's more than 1.0, then that weight class is paying more than its fair share of revenue, and if it's less than 1.0, that weight class is paying less than its fair share. Oregon's approach to highway cost allocation is based on the approach that was developed for the 1997 federal highway cost allocation, which is the most recent federal highway cost allocation, and with some improvements that were made to tailor the methods to Oregon's unique situation. The cost to allocate are budgeted expenditures over the upcoming biennium. And we include the expenditures of federal funds by the state because they're interchangeable with the state's expenditure of its own user fees. So, and the proportions of a particular project that are funded with federal funds or with state funds can change over time before the project is started and during the completion of the project. And since they are interchangeable, and since the shifting allocation, if we looked only at this at the spending of state money, the shifting of funds between different funding sources on particular projects could change the results. We treat them as we include the expenditure of federal funds, and we treat them as being fully interchangeable And the way the equity ratio works, it's okay that the total expenditures exceed the total state user fee revenues. We also include expenditures by local governments of state highway fund money. The cities and the counties each get a share of the state highway fund, and their expenditure of direct federal grants, their expenditure of federal money that passes through the state, and the expenditure of some of their own source funds. The local government own source funds that we exclude are those that are dedicated to particular purposes and are not interchangeable with state user fees. This slide shows the amounts of money expected for the upcoming biennium based on the agency request budget. So this doesn't include anything about any potential upcoming package. But the height of the blue bars is the average annual expenditure in millions of dollars, and the red notes at the top of each bar are the proportion of that category of spending that is federal funds. And you can see that that things like bridge have a much higher share of federal funds than things like maintenance. So the equity ratios are predicted for the upcoming biennium. There's three categories of forecasts that go into this process. The first is the vehicle miles of travel for the upcoming biennium. And we use ODOT's forecast for the calendar year in the middle of the biennium, so that's calendar year 2018 for this study, which we assume that the number of miles traveled in the middle 12 months of the biennium will be approximately equal to the sum of the 6 months before and the 6 months after that calendar year.
Yes, Representative Barreto.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Can we go back one slide? And what I was wondering, as far as when we talk about cost and paying your fair share, all of these, the modernization, the preservation, bridges, other engineering, maintenance, are all these basically the maintaining and modernizing the roads that are existing right now? And so when we talk about the cost, is it primarily just for maintenance and upgrades, or does it include some of the original cost to putting in those roads, or if we're looking at more the need for like a west bypass or something, you know, all of those would come, I mean, for expansion, you know, the cost that we're talking about does not include expansion, I would assume.
Chair McEwen, Representative Barreto, the answer is both, and it's a little bit complicated. The modernization category does include new roads that are part of the agency request budget for the upcoming biennium. Roads that aren't potential new roads that aren't included there are not in this at all.
Okay.
Since the various OTIA programs and the Jobs and Transportation Act, Oregon has funded a significant amount of work with bonds. And the way we handle the expenditures of bond revenue in this study is we look at how it was intended to be spent in the biennium when it was going to be spent, figure out the proportions of that money that go to cars and to various categories of trucks. And then for that study and each of the next nine studies, if these are 20-year bonds, we apply those proportions to the dollar amount of bonds, of a bond repayment that happens in each of those 10 biennia. So the past investments that were funded with bonds are treated out over the future studies until the payers of user fees are no longer repaying those bonds.
Okay. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you.
So the forecast we're looking at for 2018 includes 35.7 billion miles per year of travel by the light vehicles, and 3.1 billion miles per year by the heavy vehicles. As you can see, over 90% of the miles traveled is by heavy vehicles. The expenditures are as forecasted in the agency request budget. That budget is available in time to us to do the study, but it is subject to revisions and to packages when it gets to the legislature. And the revenue forecast assumes current law revenue instruments without any changes to rates. This graph shows vehicle miles traveled in Oregon statewide. The numbers are in billions. And the shaded area is the recession that began in 2008. What you can see is that here is that for a number of years, the number of miles traveled in Oregon was relatively flat. But starting in 2014, things really picked up. And one of the explanations for why things were relatively flat both before and immediately after the recession is that when you look at the vehicle miles traveled per person in Oregon, that was actually decreasing, even as the population was increasing. Vehicle miles traveled per person is no longer decreasing. So miles are the amount of travel in Oregon is picking up quickly, and in my experience anyway, congestion is increasing quickly in the congested parts of the state.
Well, sir, is this light vehicles and heavy vehicles?
When you're
looking at the VMT, you're counting both.
Yes, and on the right hand side, you can see the actual numbers for the 2018 forecast by weight group.
Thank you.
So the results of this study, we found an equity ratio of 1.0076 for light vehicles. They're expected to account for about 65% of the revenues and about 64% of the costs. So they're overpaying by a tiny amount if all of our forecasts hold true. For heavy vehicles, it's 0.9865. They are expected to account for 35.5% of the revenues and 36% of the costs. The reason that they aren't equal distance from 1.0 is that the dollar amounts associated with light vehicles are much higher. So a million dollar shift changes the ratio for heavy vehicles more than it does for light vehicles. And since these numbers are all based on forecasts and the margins of error in those forecasts are large enough that we can't say that these numbers are actually different from 1.0, the user fees don't need to be adjusted for equity in the upcoming biennium based on the results of this study. Now, if user fees are to be changed for other reasons, equity can be maintained out into the future by Mr. Malik using the highway cost allocation model to design the fee structure that would go along with the package. That was done most recently in 2009 when the gas tax was raised. And in the following highway cost allocation studies, it turned out that the truck rates were set appropriately and the balance remained equitable.
Madam Chair,
Malik.
This is, again, Mazen Malik, Legislative Revenue Office. Back to your question about when do we adjust the rates when they need adjusting. The study review team have gotten to an agreement a long time ago. If it's within 5%, we will not introduce a bill for adjustments. However, that we do take the opportunity of every time there is a package or there is a change in rates that happens for a transportation package to do that. So we always are bringing this equity ratio. Once we have, for example, increase in the gas tax, and that gives us a chance to change the weight mile tax rates. So we will change them accordingly to a point where we actually bring it to 100% equity. So next time around when there is a study, you get to this result. So it's the changes have been bringing the differences smaller and smaller all the time since we've done like this with four different packages. So we were always, and I remember the JTA, there was an agreement that we have the title fees and reg fees at one level, and we actually had to bring them down from the time that we were discussing and change the revenue mix in order to be able to get to that endeavor and end up basically after a few iterations into almost a perfect equity here. And that's the model that Mr. Batten passes to me, and we kind of play with it at the time of the package as we are today in order to do that for you.
So just to be clear, should you find yourselves in a situation where your allocation study indicates that there an adjustment would need to be made outside that 5%, you would have to bring a separate bill. But since we have these opportunities as time goes on, bringing transportation packages, you can embed them in those.
Precisely.
Okay. Thank you. Questions?
Chair McHugh, real quick.
Yes, and Vice Chair Meek.
Just curiosity, looking at the ratios there, they don't add up to a 2 or equalization. Where is the difference of that 9865 versus the 10076? Is that just a calculation? It's not nothing to do with equity?
Chair McHugh and Vice Chair Meek, that's a consequence of the way the equity ratio is constructed and the fact that the dollars associated with light vehicles is about twice as large as the amount of dollars associated with heavy vehicles. So, for example, if you were to move $1 million of responsibility from light vehicles to heavy vehicles, the heavy vehicle ratio would fall by more than the light vehicle ratio increases because it's a smaller part of what's already there.
But I guess my question is, it looks like at the there's a 0.0135 difference under the heavy vehicle ratio, then we only have 0.0076. So where is that? There's like probably a 0.004 some percent missing somewhere. Shouldn't they add up is my question, I guess.
No, they shouldn't.
Okay.
Might make it a little clearer if we imagine a very heavyweight class that has very few vehicles in it and a very small number of dollars associated with it. You could double the equity ratio for that weight class, and it would have an imperceptible effect on the light vehicle. So then you would, you know, looking at those two particular classes, they would add up to 3 rather than 2.
One of those geeks, sorry.
Yeah, but you mean what we're looking for is for each one of them to be 1.0. They're not matter changes, so if you increase this, not exactly works that way.
Okay.
Now, there are things, and that happens, by the way, because there are classes of vehicles that we actually subsidize. Let's say government vehicles and so on. These are subsidized vehicles that actually are paid for by the other classes. So everybody needs to pay, and all the costs need to be paid for by the revenue. If some vehicles don't pay, others would. And that part of what we call the alternative paying vehicles and so on, that all comes into the mix in order to make that difference. So we're looking for number one.
Yeah, right, guys. Great.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Much.
Further questions? All right, gentlemen, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Anything else to add? There we go.
Great. Thank you. Chair McHugh, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Daniel Porter. I'm an economist at the Oregon Department of Transportation, and I'm here today to report on the 2015 flat fee study. So this is also a study that's not required by Constitution, it's required in statute. The ODOT conduct every 2 years and report back to you on the findings of the study. We do this in conjunction with the highway cost allocation study. But the question that this study seeks to answer is different. It's not looking at equity ratios between lights and heavies. This is specifically looking at heavies, and trying to get to is, are payers of flat fees, are they revenue neutral with weight mile? So that a commodity that's eligible to pay a flat fee, so if a carrier's paying that on average, are their amount that they pay, is that not any more or less than they would have paid on weight mile? And that's the goal of the study, is that you would pay the same either way. What's a flat fee? It's a simple concept that you take a statutory rate and you multiply it by the declared weight of the vehicle in 100 pounds. And that'll give you the annual amount that you would pay. You divide that by 12, you get your monthly flat fee payment. And what's missing in that is the miles piece. And so that's the whole point of the flat fee, is that it's simplified reporting. It was created in 1949 for log haulers, because you've got these log trucks that are multiple trips per day on private and public, and calculating your weight mile tax could be burdensome. So this gives them an opportunity to just pay one flat monthly payment. You don't have to worry about how many trips and what's taxable and what isn't taxable. So that's the concept behind it. And then these are the three different classes that are eligible for flat fee. You have logs, sand and gravel, and wood chips. And as you can see, log haulers are the ones who predominantly use the flat fee.
But this is their choice. It's optional.
It is their choice completely. It is optional, yes. And about 70% of all the revenue for these commodities comes from flat fee for log haulers. Sand and gravel is much, much smaller, and a lot of reason for that is probably because they carry other things besides just these commodities that are flat fee eligible. So if you're going to pay weight mile for something else, you might as well just pay weight mile for the whole thing. It becomes simpler probably for reporting for them. And then currently we have no wood chips haulers that pay flat fee. Context, as you can see, kind of putting together the weight mile revenue with the flat fee revenue. Flat fee is a very small percentage, about 3% of the combined revenue of the two payment types. So then study results. So I got here, this chart's giving you the last three studies, 2011, 2013, 2015. ODOT actually doesn't do the study itself. We contract out, and the consultant that has done it for a long time and has used the same method, so it makes it easy to compare study to study. The vertical bars are what the revenue neutral rate would be coming out of the study for the two different classes that have used it, the sand and gravel and the log trucks. The darker ones, the sand and gravel, and the lighter green one is the log trucks. And then the horizontal bars are the two statutory rates. They're right on top of each other, so it's kind of hard to see. But 759 is the current log rate that's considered revenue neutral, and 753 is a sand and gravel rate. These are the two rates that are set in statute right now. So in 2011, you can see that sand and gravel were underpaying. So 968 would have been what their revenue neutral rate should have been in order for them to pay the same amount that they would have paid under weight mile. And then for that same year in 2011, log truck revenue neutral rate is about 766. So it's pretty much right on. Mm-hmm. And then there was little change at all between 2011 and 2013. And then in 2015, we see both of them declining. And the reason is that in sand and gravel's case, we had number of miles also declining and revenue declining. But miles dropped faster than revenue, so they brought their rate down. And in log truck's case, we had revenue about the same, but we had miles declining. So, and if you look at harvest levels for timber harvest levels, it makes sense. In 2013, harvest levels are higher than in 2015. So like a firm would still be going and making trips. They may be making as many trips between the forest and the mill. So they're going to pay the same amount of flat fee, but they're just less miles. So their overall overpayment Yeah, they were right on. Now they're overpaying a little bit. All right, so their revenue rate would be 703. So we take a study to the Oregon Transportation Commission, and these are the recommendation coming out of that is that we would recommend these rates be changed to 869 as the revenue neutral rate for sand and gravel and 703 for log haulers.
And so that has not been done yet, or that will go before the OTC at some time in the future?
It has been already before OTC, okay. But this is a statutory rate.
Okay.
So it would need to be done. Again, if we're talking about a package, this could be something that could be
built in.
It would have to be adjusted anyways if there is a package, because you're adjusting weight mile.
I think when there's a package, sir, would be a good way to characterize this.
Thank you, Jeremy Hewitt.
Thank
when
you.
There's a package. So that's the flat fee study. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
So, is there else? Then I believe that concludes our informational meeting on highway cost allocation. So thank you all for your patience and your interest. I believe we have our good senator here, so we will now move on. Oh, great. We got everybody here. Thank you. Everybody's in the room. We'll be open a public hearing on House Bill 2749, please. And you know what? I think we're just going to open them both on House Bill 2749 and 2750. Gentlemen, thank you for joining our committee this morning. We're happy to have you here.
Glad to be here.
Enlighten us about bridges in Hood River. Mr. Walker.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, House Bill 2749 directs the Port of Hood River and the Department of Transportation to study the feasibility of replacing the Hood River White Salmon Bridge, authorize issuance of $5 million in lottery bonds to finance the study, declares an emergency, and is effective for passage. House Bill 2750 permits the Port of Hood River to establish a toll on bridges. The Port of Hood River has authority to operate and maintain, outlines under what circumstances the Port of Hood River is subject to state contracting processes and prevailing wage rates, land use laws, and to be able to pursue the public-private partnerships.
In any order you choose, gentlemen.
Well, thank you, Chair McEwen, members of the committee. Great to be here. Appreciate the opportunity to be here to talk about issue that's close to those of us that live in the Gorge. Hood River in the Mid-Gorge region is a really fast-growing region that has tremendous potential for job growth and economic development. It's located on a critical transportation corridor, and the Hood River White Salmon Bridge is a critical component of the regional transportation system in the area. Events over the past 24 months have highlighted just how important the bridge is to cross-state and interstate commerce. During both the train derailment in Mosier last June and the weather-related closures of I-84 this winter, the bridge has served a critical alternative emergency route. These events highlighted the terrible condition of the bridge as diverting heavy vehicles damaged the weakened bridge and emergency vehicles passed within inches of each other trying to cross the river. Oregonians from all over the state are flocking to the region as well. Some just stay the night and intend on recreating and expect to be able to get across the bridge on foot or via bicycle. Rather than finding
Representative
safe passage,
Johnson,
foot
I'm
traffic,
sorry to interrupt you, but
I am Mark Johnson.
Thank you very
much. District 52. Thank you very much. Privileged to live in Hood River and wonderful to be here to talk about this.
Thank you, Representative Johnson.
For the record, thank you. Rather than finding safe passage, foot traffic or bicycle passage is a harrowing experience and is to be avoided for all but the faint of heart. Others come to live and work in Hood River or surrounding communities on both sides of the river. Having a safe, reliable bridge facilitates job creation and allows our businesses to attract top talent. These two bills before you today won't rebuild the bridge alone. Together, however, passing House Bill 2750 and investing $5 million in the project to allow the Port of Hood River to move to the next step by providing the tools to appropriately evaluate and choose the right replacement model, whether a public-private partnership or a traditional publicly funded project, will make a huge difference in making this reality, making this hoped-for bridge become a reality sometime in our lifetime. So I really urge your support of these bills and appreciate being able to be here to talk about them today. And with that, here's my
Thank you.
I was going to say junior member, but former classmate, by the way.
I'm older than you are.
We graduated in the same class,
yeah.
Clear Valley High School class of 70-something.
And I think I'm older than you actually by a month.
You are older.
So. Yeah, so I am the senior.
The senior member.
Yeah, no argument.
Just glad to hear you both graduated.
Yeah.
We don't say that. 40-40-20.
Welcome, Senator.
Chair McHugh, Vice Chair Mate, Committee, thanks for having us today. It's my pleasure to be here to talk about the Hood River White Salmon Bridge. I think the thing was actually built in the 1700s. It goes way back. And,
the Bridge
and
of the Gods.
Definitely.
I think.
I think it was there before they came here. And we definitely need a new bridge. We have businesses, fruit businesses on the white salmon side of the river, the Washington side of the river. Personally, a lot of growers on the Oregon side, myself included, take fruit to that side. Logging companies on both sides of the river, a lot of commerce that way, and Sitsu's over there. So the gorge is, it's the way the gorge system works, it's like the Skamania and Klickitat counties have to work with Hood River and Wasco counties with the commerce and business we have there, and as far as housing. So those bridges are critical for just everyday life, getting back and forth across the river. If you've ever driven across that bridge, you'd know the necessity to replace that thing. Once a year, I get the privilege of driving a semi-truck with 80,000 pounds of fruit over across that bridge.
No more than 80.
Yeah. Oh, I'm not going to say that on record, for goodness sakes. Jeez. Because that's the limit, isn't it? We carry 79,850 pounds across the bridge every time I go across.
Now there is twitching, Senator.
Yes, and there's probably this much on each side of your truck. And this is the honest truth. This last summer, I was driving across the bridge, and I saw this mobile home coming at me, and it was across the line by this much. So
Senator,
I'm driving, and I barely have time.
Senator, I'm sorry to interrupt
yes.
you.
Did I say where I was from?
Your name for the record, please.
Crap. Do you always wait till we're halfway through to do that?
I was giving you lots of opportunities.
Yes, you did. Senator Chuck Thompson, District 26.
Thank you, sir. We're very grateful.
Where were we?
Yeah. I remember where it was. So I'm driving across the bridge, 25 miles an hour, that's all. It seems like you're going 80. It's so narrow, and you just have to pick a spot and go and hope you're within that line. And then I see a mobile home. It's that far over the line. So and I'm a good enough truck driver that I can drive, stay within my lane, and wave my arm at this guy coming at me. And we hit mirrors. And just shatters and all that. So it costs, you got to go to the Napa Auto Parts store and cost another $15-$20 to put a new mirror on. And that's a very common occurrence. The thing is, it's way outdated. They're constantly maintenance in it. It's a metal bridge, so they got the welders out there almost once a month or twice a month. You get lane closures because they're constantly have to maintain the bridge. So the Port of Hood River and its partners here in Oregon and Washington have completed lots of work to look at getting a new bridge. Passing the two bills will allow the port and its partners to correctly identify the best replacement solution and make sure all options are fully investigated. And I urge the support and passage of these two bills. Thanks, committee.
Thank you, Senator. I happen to have a rail bridge with similar issues, but we don't have the problem of them crossing,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
which is important.
Thanks.
Welcome.
Be sure to say your name.
I think the message
Chairman is... Chairman McEwen, for the record, Michael McKelvey, Executive Director of Port of Hood River. I'm honored to sit between my senator and my representative, and I don't think I can match their sense of humor, but I perhaps can remember to state my name in the future. So I'm here to describe the background and provide a little bit of information for your consideration relative to House Bill 2749-2750. I report to a 5-member elected board. Our board recognizes not only the need to invest in infrastructure around the state, we strongly support your efforts, Representative McLean, Chairman McEwen, to forge a funding strategy and an approach to help fund and improve our infrastructure in the state of Oregon. My board believes strongly that this bridge, the Hood River White Salmon Bridge, should be part of that package in some fashion. And these two elements that are before you will each in their own way help us take the next significant step forward to replacement of the bridge. We recognize, and everyone recognizes, this is not a quick process, but we need to take this next step forward, and now's the time to do it. I want to give you a little bit of background, if I could, because I think it helps frame the context for your consideration. The bridge sits at River Mile 169, about halfway, midway in the National Scenic Area in the Columbia Gorge. The bridge exists because of the Congressional Bridge Act of 1906. Based on that act, in 1923, the Congress authorized a private company, the Oregon-Washington Bridge Company, to build a bridge, a toll bridge, owned-operated at River Mile 169, connecting White Salmon and Bingen to Hood River. The bridge was opened in 1924 in December, and the toll was a dollar. It was 75 cents for the first head of cattle and a discount for the herd. Bicycles were 50 cents. So in some ways, if you look back, this project was the original public-private partnership in the state, but based on congressional action. In 1939, the Secretary of War told the company they needed to raise the bridge and install a lift span because of the construction of Bonneville Dam, which raised the pool level. That work was done with federal funding, and the Oregon-Washington Bridge Company operated until 1949. At that time, they ran into financial problems and offered the bridge up to anybody, public or private, interested in purchasing it. So it was offered to the state of Oregon, the state of Washington, counties, cities, and ports within in both states. There was one entity that stepped up and offered to purchase it. That was the Port of Hood River. So it was purchased in 1950 for $800,000, and the port immediately reduced the toll to 50 cents. I'd look back on that time and the elected officials I report to and their predecessors and wonder about the risks they took and the challenges they took on in purchasing that piece of infrastructure, an interstate bridge, knowing of the risk and knowing of the uncertainty about how to operate it. But they did, and over the course of the subsequent 67 or so years, the port has invested on the order of $50 to $60 million in the bridge in current year dollars. So just briefly to finish that, Oregon legislature in 1949, I should have said, had authorized the ownership and operation of toll bridges. And based on that, Oregon legislative action is the reason for the port to purchase it. And then briefly, in 2006, we installed an electronic tolling system. It's the only one, to my knowledge, in the state of Oregon. To my knowledge, there's only two toll bridges in the state, and coincidentally enough, they're in my senators and representative districts in Hood River County, and only 15 miles apart. Ours is a toll bridge, and it currently has a breeze-by account roster of over 10,000 accounts. It allows someone to go through the system without stopping to pay the toll. We are currently engaged in an effort to upgrade that toll system on the order of magnitude of $1.2 million to be state-of-the-art and to have reciprocity and interoperability with the states of California and Washington, Nevada, Utah, and because that's the regional approach that is being taken around the country. So that's a little bit of background, but I want to give you that context for the bridge and a little bit about its history. So why should it be replaced? I think the reasons have been mentioned very well here already, but its efficiency rating is below 50. It's deteriorated condition. It doesn't have bicycle or pedestrian facilities. Critically, it's deficient in seismic resiliency. There have been bridge conferences where this bridge has been pointed out as the poster child for catastrophic failure in the event of a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. And it's primarily because you have large, high towers with very the counterweights are very heavy at the top. So in a Cascadia earthquake, there's going to be a lot of resonance over minutes, and those will probably be in the water. The bridge crosses a federal waterway, so the inland waterway system from Astoria to Lewiston, Idaho, where a lot of soybeans and a lot of wheat and a lot of goods ship and connect our eastern and western sides of our state, pass right through the bridge. And that, you will talk to pilots, will say that lift span, that bridge opening, is the worst, most harrowing, most challenging part of the whole inland waterway system. So as was mentioned, it's a significant bottleneck. Regularly, on average once a year, we become part of the interstate highway system. That's very, very challenging for us because depending on if it's one or both ways, an 80,000-pound bridge that takes fruit trucks, 79,900, will suddenly have rigs of 120,000 plus going both directions, and there's no way to stop that. So when that happens, our guys are out there welding for many, many days to get that metal bridge back in place. We recognize the need to have that as an alternate route when an emergency occurs, but we also want people to recognize the damage that occurs after that happens, and there's no compensation for that. So, some of it up, it's some of the bridge is 93 years old. Other parts are almost 80 years old. And that's when the bridge was, the useful life, the design life of a bridge in that era was probably 50 to 60 years. We have to do something about this. And again, the commission I report to says we must take that next significant step forward. And the two bills before you, we hope, will do that. So, I just want to move fast and say that there is hope. There's been a lot of work done. And frankly and ironically, the work that's been done has been done by virtue of the energy and funding that's been that come out of the state of Washington, because the stakeholders in Washington State have an equal and, frankly, in some ways more compelling interest in a new bridge. So the draft EIS is done. The type, size, and location study is done. It's now on the national highway system, which is critical for federal funding. It is now named, not the bridge itself, but the type of project and NSAs are named in the FAST Act, which was approved by Congress in 2015, which simply allows an additional amount of acknowledgement and identification of a key project or key types of projects, which single out the National Scenic Area. And we've also submitted a Fastlane application, as I believe three other projects have been submitted in the current round. Based on the administrative, the change in administrations, the projects at the Fastlane level are, I guess you'd say, still being considered and processed, but there's been no, and we don't know when a decision will be made on those. So the two bills, 2750 briefly provides the statutory authorities that allow the port to proceed and take that next significant step. Remember that the bridge was originally built by a private entity. What we need and what we want at this point is to have the widest door open, the door open as wide as possible to consider all options. The more typical publicly funded project would be a design bid build or a design build with public money. That is a possibility, but it's challenging with the need to assemble different sources of funding. The alternative is a P3 project or public-private partnership, which has been, there's been successful examples in British Columbia, none to my knowledge in Oregon yet, although it has been looked at extensively, as you know, by the legislature, and some other examples around the country. It's not clear yet whether this project with this sort of traffic volume can accommodate or support a P3 project. In 2016, for the first time, we exceeded 4 million trips across the bridge, trucks and cars. Is that enough to capitalize and to underwrite private equity or not? Not sure. But we need to understand that. We need to pursue that as a possibility. So we want to keep both options open. I just want to pause, and I'm almost done. We have been thankful for the collaboration and the feedback we've received from ODOT on this. And one concern that has been expressed is the uncertainty about whether the request, $5 million, is sufficient to pay for the final EIS and these other feasibility steps, and including geotechnical assessment. We believe it is. We believe it is because this has been these time frames and the cost estimates are driven from Parsons Brinckerhoff, which is a significant engineering firm and one that did the DEIS and did the TSNL and knows the project very well. But we also acknowledge the uncertainty of the permit process. It could take longer. It could cost more money. And so what I want to say for the record is the port recognizes that and understands that if there are additional costs that are incurred because of the extended process, that the port would step up and take care of any additional costs. We're comfortable with the number. If it exceeds it, we're gonna take care of it. So that just basically concludes my remarks. I'll just say that the counterpoint or the alternate path, if we don't have the tools to proceed and take that next step, would be to, frankly, hunker down, try to keep the bridge open as long as possible. The risks go up for a barge strike or an earthquake damage, and we would have to invest in the bridge and keep it open as long as possible. Our only one possible tool is to reduce the weight limit from 80,000 to 8,000, which is what occurred in Cascade Locks 2 years ago. It's severely detrimental to our economy and to our growers and our loggers and, frankly, our technology companies. So I'll conclude. I'll say thank you for the time this morning. I appreciate your attention, and I urge your support.
Yes. Vice Chair Vile.
Madam Chair, thank you very much for the presentation, and I'm encouraged to hear just how much work has already gone into this. I'm curious about the tolling piece that you talked about. Currently, you've got the breeze-by system working pretty well.
Right.
You talked about the interstate compact that's been discussed. Have you got the software systems already identified and in place to be able to institute that?
Chair McEwen, Representative Vile, we are in the process of installing there's software, there's hardware, there's new loops that are needed, and there's the requisite agreements. Those are underway. Our board just yesterday approved a $250,000 contract to CAPS. We intend to have it open and the new system operational by July.
Follow up?
Yes.
ODOT's indicated some concerns about just how much it costs to set those type of systems up. Do you think that the system that you guys are putting in place now would be something that could be translated elsewhere in the state if we began to use that concept elsewhere?
Representative McEwen, Representative Vile, yes. In fact, Cascade Locks is also a tolled bridge. They are pursuing electronic tolling, and they have asked us to be their system operator and their back of house. And it's very scalable. Once you've established the system, and we are, frankly, the experts in Oregon right now, we can scale this up and accommodate other agencies that may need the support system for it. The software is once you've got it in place, the software is a known quantity, and the systems are utilized by other agencies around the country. So we are endeavoring to take on that role, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have two more witnesses who would like to come and testify. Scott Boardman and Paul Mather, please. Good morning.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Scott Boardman. I'm with the West Coast Infrastructure Exchange. We are a 501c3 nonprofit located in Portland that was created by the governors and treasurers of the three West Coast states. And we provide training, education, and technical assistance to public organizations within those three states on the topic of public-private partnerships, or a term that we prefer to use is performance-based infrastructure. And so the idea being that you are consolidating responsibility for the key aspects of a project's life cycle, being the design, construction, and long-term maintenance, into a single performance-based contract with the private sector. We're agnostic, generally speaking, about whether that includes private financing and private operations, but it's something that we look at a case-by-case basis to see what the best value is for the public. And so I'm here today to put my support behind HB 2749 in the sense that as the Port of Hood River considers its delivery options and financing options as well, that's something that WCX could certainly assist with. We have the backing of Partnerships BC, which is a crown corporation in British Columbia that runs complex procurements using this model of integrating those design, build, finance, operate, maintain functions for large capital projects. And so we simply want to lend our support and our assistance in any way possible as the port considers the delivery options for this type of bridge.
Thank you. I might note that the West Coast Infrastructure Exchange is not unknown to this body. I think in the last two sessions, we've had presentations from them on projects that have been successfully completed in British Columbia. Our current treasurer, then state representative, Tobias Reed, I believe he is the chair of your board of directors. Is that correct? Or has he stepped off?
He has recently stepped off.
Okay. We had also Laura Lockwood McCall from our She's still the treasurer of your organization? I'm just looking at your website.
Treasurer of our organization, okay. Yes, and she's the director of the debt management division here with the state.
Which is very appropriate. And Representative Bentz, I believe, participated on your board at one point in time.
I don't believe that he did.
Or am I thinking of something else?
I don't think we had any other representatives on our board aside from Representative Reed when he was on there.
Great. Thank you. So I just want you to know this is an organization that's familiar to a number of us. We have seven new members.
Sure.
So I just want to make sure that they're aware that you're just not walking in here as an unknown.
Yes. Thank you, Chairman Kinney. We've been around for about 3 years now.
Yeah.
Again, you know, we were created by the governors and treasurers of Washington, Oregon, and California, the idea being that, you know, as we recognize our infrastructure needs going forward, that the traditional design bid build method might not be sufficient in order to, you know, meet those needs. And so, again, we provide training, education, technical assistance, pre-development activity work for public organizations in the attempt to secure the best value for the public. Again, we're generally, you know, if it turns out that a design bid build method is found to secure the most value, then we're happy with that. But we just want to make sure that decision makers are aware of their options. And as the Port of Hood River potentially considers a public-private partnership for the procurement of a potential replacement bridge, we just want to lend our support in any way that we can, you know, help with that.
Thank you. Vice Chair Vile has a question.
Chair McKeown, Scott, just tell us how your organization is funded, if you would, please.
Sure. Vice Chair Vile, Chair McKeown. We were originally funded by the legislatures of the three states as well as an initial round of foundation money, and we are still operating off of those initial infusions.
Thank you very much. Thank you, ma'am.
Anyone else? All right. Mr. Mather, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, member of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. I just wanted to share just a couple of thoughts specific to House Bill 2749. As the owner of several of these very large bridges built in this era, we understand the challenges of putting together a project of this complexity. And one of the things we know in putting those projects together, an important aspect of that is having clear lines of roles and responsibilities, who is in lead of the project, and then the various players involved, specifically what their role is. With this specific, if this bill passes and moving forward this project, ODOT will have a role in this. Our desire is to keep that role at a minimum level. We certainly have a role in the federal nexus that this project would have, as well as it connects to our interchange. But having clear leadership from the port and having them clearly in charge of the project would be our desire as we put the intergovernment agreement together to make this happen. As we read the bill, there's some ambiguity or questions in our mind around the funding responsibilities as well as ODOT's role. We've been working with the proponents of the bill to clarify some of those things, to keep those keep ODOT's role to a minimum. And so, again, when we sign that intergovernmental agreement, we have set a statute that supports a minimal role for ODOT. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So, Mr. Mather, do you have an amendment to propose? Are you working with the proponents to see if there's a way that we can move forward that keeps you comfortable and solves their problem?
Madam Chair, we had a very productive meeting yesterday afternoon, agreed with several of the concepts. We're just working on specific language.
Thank you. Vice Chair Vial.
Chair McEwen, Paul, thanks for being here. And I'm just wondering if, rather than trying to put into the legislative piece itself those kinds of details, are you not confident that that can be worked out in the intergovernmental agreement, or are you worried that it can't be worked out and you need our help? Why not sort of let the general stuff go through and then work it out?
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Vial, I guess our concern would be that statute would limit our ability, when we put that intergovernmental agreement together, would limit our ability to minimize ODOT's role, that based on language that we see in the bill gives us concern that we would have to play a larger role than we would want to, or I think, frankly, than the port would want us to play in it. So we'd just be, again, clear of the language to allow that minimal role as we put that agreement together.
Follow up.
Yes.
I've got particular interest in knowing what those issues might be and how that language might be developed, so I'd appreciate perhaps the opportunity to be involved in those discussions. Okay. Thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks.
Anyone else care to weigh in on these two bills? If not, then I am going to close our public hearing on House Bill 2750 and 2749. Mr. Walker, can you update us on what's coming up next Wednesday, please?
Chairman Kuhl, members of the committee, next Wednesday we will have five public hearings, House Bill 2083, 2293, 3089, 3119, and 2596. We will have two work sessions on House Bills 2290 and 2320.
Anything for the good of the order? We are adjourned. Thank you. We are adjourned. Thank you.